Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. The greatest kitchen gadget ever after the cooker. I don't do microwaves, so I can't be bothered with the microwave. So yeah, I think it goes cooker, then cooker. So cooker as in the one with the like the flames and the heat and the gas and the electric and the induction, and then cooker, the hot water tap. Do you know what I used it for last week? Getting chewing gum off my daughter's jeans. This is the gadget that keeps giving. She was panicking. Dad, I got chewing gum. I sat down and chewing gum, I've only got like 15 pairs of jeans, and this one's got chewing gum on them, and it's the one I need to use. So I just did it. I put it in the hot water, melted it, scrubbed it off. Did well. Actually, it's fascinating watching my daughter do that, lose the plot, because it's so doing this podcast for all these years and sort of spending a lot of time reading books, and especially sort of self-helpy books and philosophy books and books on stoicism and all that sort of stuff. It's interesting watching the panic and how important that chewing gum, to get that chewing gum off the jeans, was in that moment. And the reality is that this, the thing I do that my mates always take the mickey out of me is, you know, if you think about death every day, it allows you to live. And I always, whenever I get like, really frustrated, I always think, on my deathbed, am I seriously gonna be sitting there thinking, oh my god, I've got chewing gum on my jeans? You know, it's just such a nonsense. There's such small things that we get so caught up in the small detail of life, and it brings us down a bit. I lost my sunglasses the other day. Don't know what I've done with them. Phoned around a few places. You know, I can afford another pair of sunglasses, but they were ones I really liked. And there was this moment that I started getting really frustrated, really angry about it. And then again, on my deathbed, am I going to give a damn about that set of sunglasses? No. So get on with your life. For more details on hot water taps, go to cooker.co.uk. So this hour, I'm curious about radio DJ Christian O'Connell and his decision to leave a successful radio show in the UK and set up in Australia, where no one knew him. Christian has actually written a book called No One Listens to Your Dad's Show, From Number One to No One. It's the story of his journey from Absolute Radio to going off to work on radio in Australia. Christian, a few weeks ago, put up on his social media that he was looking to do some podcasts in the UK to promote this book. And one of his followers said, why don't you do Tim Lovejoy's podcast? Go on this one. So we just arranged it. Now, I've known Christian for years, since we were both on XFM together. What I can tell you about Christian is he works really hard and he's very ambitious. He went from, in the time I knew him, he went from XFM to Virgin, and they changed the name to Absolute. Along the way, he just kept picking up radio awards. I think on his book or his PR stuff, they said he won 25 radio awards, which is like, awards mean something in radio. They mean more. We'll talk to him about it, actually. They mean so much more in radio. When I go to those Sony Awards, when I used to do XFM and Five Live and stuff, and I used to go to Sony Awards, and you go to the TV awards, people win and lose, and they go, on radio, because it's all about you. And if you've won a Sony Award, oh my God, you keep your job. And not only that, you might be able to go and ask for a pay rise. If you don't, or you don't even get on the nominations, the bosses start looking at you. It's really strange. I think that's because the RAJARs, which is the system for judging radio, is still a pen and paper. I mean, I could have got this wrong, but when I was doing it, it was like the RAJARs would come in, the whole radio stations would panic, because they knew the papers would pick up on it and report it, and especially if you were the big shows. So they would absolutely panic about it, and you know, all the bosses would sit down, and I'd go, how are they calculating this stuff? And they go, oh yeah, people with a pen and paper. And I'm like, well, that's crap that our careers are on people with pens and papers at home. Anyway, we'll talk to him about that. Anyway, he gave up everything to move to Australia. Seemed a really weird decision at the time. Let's find out why. Here he is. It's Christian O'Connell. Christian, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. Mate, what's Australia like with COVID? Are you just living a normal life out there?
We were. And like for a couple of weeks, I was at the MCG, you know, with 70,000 sports fans. This like, you know, and you're next to each other thinking this is the best place in the world right now. And then now I'm talking to you and we're back in lockdown in total. This is day number 164 that Melbourne's done in lockdown in the last 15 months. We're back in a snap 7-day one. They call it a circuit breaker, all this language around it now.
Why are you locked down? Is someone over there? How many people have tested positive? Like one or two or something?
Normally, we went into a 7-day one because four people tested positive. And I thought you thought us Brits were uptight. What happened to Crocodile Dundee? No worries. But no, it's got quite high very quickly. And they just want to, the vaccine's been really slow to roll out here. So they just want to get control of it again.
Can I just ask you, I don't want to get too political. I'm not looking for a headline here, Christian, off you, but what did the Australians think of the way we're doing it over here? Because we're in Ireland and we decided not to lock our borders, whereas Australia, which is a big island, and New Zealand, which is an island, huge island, the size of Europe island, but they decided to lock their borders and it seems to have worked. It means that the people out there can actually have a good time and carry on living their lives.
It has worked, but then the other thing is there's been one thing the UK's done brilliantly and is rolled out the vaccine.
Yeah,
you know, it's still really, it's getting there now because we're back in lockdown. So I went to get vaccinated today and thousands of people are trying to do it every day now, where 2 weeks ago, no one wanted to do it because international borders won't open up here for another year. So a lot of people are like, well, what's the point? The numbers are low. We were all out and about 2 weeks ago. So I think Britain's got that bit right. And Boris, but then we all know now what Boris has been up to. I mean, he's spent too much time shagging. He hasn't had time to worry about such trifling matters of COVID. I think he was the same as Trump. I think that they were too slow to make the changes that they should have done.
Yeah, maybe. All right, let's talk about your book, Christian. I didn't know what to expect picking it up because I really enjoyed it. I've got to say, thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you, Tim. That means a lot from you, mate.
And you know what? I did find it very inspiring. And if you want to get inspired, because Christian made some big decisions in his life, and the biggest being to leave a very successful radio show, which I just said in my intro that I know how hard you worked. Ever since I've known you, you've worked really hard and you've been very ambitious. And so to give all that up when you'd built something so big to go to Australia was a huge decision. I suppose the best way to start is by you telling us about the book and what it's about.
The book is about why did I leave a comfort zone, and they called a comfort zone for a reason because they're really comfortable. And I left it, and it wasn't just like I walked out. There's always stuff that sort of, I don't know about you, Tim, but the moment I got into my 40s, I'm 48 now. The moment I got into my 40s, it was like shit got real. All those certainties you've been building up for years, right? Career, status, the house, kitchen island, all that stuff, awards, external, you know, evidence that I'm good at this, we've been rewarded for it, that all suddenly all those certainties fell away, and my kids were suddenly, you know, heading into teenagers, and I'm realizing how many more years have I got of them needing this kind of dad? And even that, it's like they're changing a job description. I'm more like a sort of, you know, it's when you go from a soccer coach goes to being the technical director, you're a consultant. And suddenly you start to think you're in the second half of your life without you realizing it. And you've got you're struggling with all these inner thoughts. You don't really know what to do with them or how to handle them. We've not been trained that way. And it's not to blame your mum and dad or anything. It's just, we're just not been trained. We don't know how to speak about them. And so I guess it's been bubbling around in me for a while. And then I had what really kickstarted the move here. And this is a strange way to set it up, was I think I've always had anxiety since I was a teenager, but being a child of the 80s, anxiety hadn't been invented then. It wasn't really an option to wander around telling people that you're a bit sensitive, you know, and hope to get a career in the arts. And so it was just, you know, I do what probably a lot of kids do when you're a teenager, if you feel a bit sort of an outsider, not sure if you fit in. And that's all of us. That's just being a teenager. I used alcohol. I probably learned some wrong lessons about that along the way. and also some good times as well. It was, and then what happened is about six or seven years ago, I had some really bad anxiety attacks, like really severe. So bad, they're very specific. They were right before a radio show. And radio had always been one of those things, probably like radio and TV for you, that I just enjoyed. It was play. It was where I came alive. And I'd never felt any anxiety around that element of my life. It was where I felt in control with being out of control and that live element. I felt, this is what I do. This is my joy. And I deeply love it. It has a real meaning to me. I know why I get out of bed still in the morning after 23 years of breakfast radio. And then suddenly to have fear and anxiety attacks around that, making it possible for me to do shows. I would literally walk out the radio station 15 minutes beforehand. And I can look back now and see that I was having something, you know, I was having a breakdown. And it was utterly terrifying. I had an identity around being that radio guy. And it wasn't so much shtick for me. I brought a lot of my real life to the show, but it still gave me an identity. And the threat of losing that and losing my job, my livelihood, and what that meant to me as a man, to my wife and my daughters was horrific, like real dark night of the soul. And, you know, this is my version of what happened. Everyone's got their own, you know, anxiety and fear and, yeah, dealing with loss and various stuff all come to us at various moments and shapes and forms of life. But this is how it came to me. So I got help, and that wasn't easy. I felt like my wife said, look, you're going to need help dealing with this. And she was great. She said, let's sell the house. Let's take a break. Why don't you take a break away from radio for 6 months and maybe retrain to do. She said, you've always talked about being a hairdresser, but that was just one of those. Yeah, you can't stop. Retrain like Daniel Day-Lewis when he just quit acting to go and be a shoe cobbler in Ireland. It's like, what are those going to pay the, I still got a hairdressing in my mid-40s. I'm doing an apprenticeship at Tony and Guy, you know. But she was just trying to take the pressure off. I was like, this is my skill set so narrow. There's only been this. There were no, I that isn't, I can't give it up. That's too much. I'm giving me up. Anyone I went to get
Christian,
help.
Can I just tell you that I wanted to be a hairdresser, yes, as a kid. I've said this on my.
We should open up our own salon.
Exactly. And my mum wouldn't let me do the training. She said no, and I don't know why, but she said
no. What do you think that says about us? I guess we like talking to people. We're creative. I kind of thought that looks like quite a nice thing to do. You're chatting to people. That's what I thought. A natter.
Yeah, you just stand there and chat to people all day long. So we ended up doing the same job, just standing in TV studios and radio studios. And
somewhere right now, there's two sinks in a West London salon that should have been asked him what could have been in life.
Well, do you know what? That's seriously what happened to me. I just to quickly tell you my story.
Yeah.
I sat there one day going, right, I tried working in clothes shops, I tried finance, I tried everything, and I was all right at all this sort of stuff, but I wasn't really getting the buzz. I thought, what can I do? And I thought, I can talk. That was literally the decision I made, was like, well, I'll be TV presenter. I want to do that. That's what I want to do. I've always wanted to work on radio, like it says in your book. And it's like, fuck it, I'll do it. And so that's when I went off, and then I started telling everybody, hey, I'm going to be a TV presenter. And then they all looked at me like I was a knob. And, you know, I probably did sound like one. And then I ended up on telly. So, you know, there's a little bit in between that. But but go on. So you're having your breakdown. You were going to retrain as a hairdresser.
Yeah, I know. And so I went to go and see a therapist. I'd never seen one before. And just that walk to go to his the first time was really hard. I was like, in my head, it was like, I shouldn't be here. You know, therapy's a fuck up. So I'm not a fuck up. I've done really well in my life. I've worked hard. This is awful. And the therapist I found happened to work out of, and I'm not making this up, he was working out of a shed in the bottom of his garden, right, in South London. And it was a nice shed. You know, he had like tiles in there, but it was a shed. And so every week I go, and at first it was arms folded. And I said, you know, I sort of said to him, I remember when I first sat down, I went, I don't want to be here. And he smiled as if like, here we go. Another guy, not the first and not the last to say that I don't want to be here. And he really helped me. And it was one of the best things I ever did. And it is actually, although my wife sort of nudged me, said, you're going to need help to get through this. Actually, it's our responsibility to go and get help. It is only ever our responsibility to get help and look after our spiritual health. We call it mental health, but that's my responsibility. So I'm glad I did go and do it. And I learned some new stuff. I unlearned some stuff. And through the process, I started to realize how I've been numbing myself down from a couple of sort of burning questions that have been in me for a couple of years, really. And I've been overworking. I don't know if you've done this to the point of distraction, because suddenly, you know, when we're not very good at sitting just with ourselves, are we? You're frightened of what's going to come up. Like what, you know, if you just sit in silence, suddenly there's that going to be, you're all alone. You're going to die. It's all futile.
The time I went to a therapist, Christian, what happened was I was like, you really talk about this in your book, and it's really good, great the way you talk about it. I felt like I was on a cliff edge, and I was just basically hanging on in there. And I had a successful career, and I had everything that everyone would say, you know, wow. And I achieved everything I wanted to achieve. I was on TV and, you know, everything, but I was just hanging on because it had all broken. Yeah. It slowly started breaking
it
down.
It crumbles, doesn't it?
And it was a physiotherapist who dealt with the Olympians, the rowing team. Yeah, I'd gone to see him about a bad back, which it consequently is to do with the stress.
Of course it would.
And he just put this piece of paper in my hand right at the end of the session, goes, give this guy a ring. I think he might help you. And I was like, oh, if he looks after athletes, he must be, you know, I must be, I'm an athlete. But I saw him and I saw him for an hour, and I spent the first 45 minutes crying. And that's what you say in your book, is you let it out, don't you? The tears and stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? You're right. That hanging on, that's what I think. And on paper like you, my ratings had never been higher. And I'd never won more awards. So I had it, everything that I'd really been building for, you know? Mm. But I still felt at some point, some element in my life, I was hanging on. And what it was that I guess some stuff had been there that I'd never really fully dealt with, Tim. And it keeps coming back. And then I think it does for men. And I know it does for women as well, but for men, I think it starts with a physical deterioration. It's like it needs to be something that really gets our attention, because sometimes we're not very good at listening to our own inner body, our own inner wisdom. We numb it down in various ways, or you look the other way from yourself. You don't want to acknowledge what's really going on there because you're scared that it's too much. I won't be able to put myself back together. And so I start to realize that for a couple of years, I'd lost my mojo. And talking to my wife, she realized that we both felt the same way, that we'd made our lives a bit too small. And we didn't want it to be like, shit, has all the exciting stuff happened in our life now? We're in our mid-40s. We're in the second half of life. Is it now? So in a couple of years' time, the kids will just fuck off. What's more heartbreaking than that? Every birthday they have, they're getting closer to walking out the door. How is that not heartbreaking? And then you're like, what are we going to do now? You know, and we'd always loved Australia. We've always made our life an adventure. My wife, you know, before I got into radio, she moved to Bournemouth. She quit her legal job as a lawyer. She's a couple years older than me. She moved with me to Bournemouth, to Liverpool, to London, to XFM. You know, she was instrumental to putting this move together out here. So we've always enjoyed taking risks and leaps into the unknown. But this is a very strong reaction to having anxiety attacks, to suddenly going, hey, I'm going to move to Australia and start again as an unknown, where a lot of people don't like Brits. Don't know if you've seen the Ashes. They're not going to they're not going to give you the keys to the city, all right, when you come here. And it was a real baptism of fire. Even if you don't understand radio in the world, the world's most competitive place for radio is Australia. You know, shows are fired within 6 months at breakfast time here. And I was met with an enormous backlash. And I must have been some kind of mug, thinking that, oh, I've had backlashes before. This would be all right. I'm a funny chappy. I know radio. They really take to my warm, eccentric English ways. And it was just from day one, no, don't know who you are. I remember getting an email at the end of the first week that said no one invited you. And I felt like I was back at school. You know, that kid that your mum made you invite you to your party because he had no mates. I felt like that. And I was like, what the hell have I done? And it's all on me. There's no backup plan. You know, everything was on me doing this radio show, making it work. I'd taken the kids here, out of their schools, their friends, my wife as well. And so it was this year of everything being new, everything being unknown, everything we'd taken our lives for granted, where the doctor is, where you go and get your dry cleaning, where you get your Wi-Fi, getting a phone, everything. You didn't know anything. And then about 3 months in, I suddenly realized, I've got no mates. You never even think about that when you think I'll move to the side of the world. I just remember a Friday night, getting my phone out, instinctively going, I'd see who's around for a beer, just for an early doors one. It's been a bit of a strange week. I'm thinking, there's no one. I've got no mate.
Can I just say at this point, selling your book, what is great? It's full of great anecdotes. As if anyone who knows Christian, which I'm sure many of you will, it's just like beautiful stories about how you're actually honest and truthful, because that's your style of DJing, was always honest and truth, and you're honest and truth with how you're feeling. And that bit about you not having any friends is really funny. How do men, and you try, I'm going to just ruin a bit, where you try and befriend an Uber driver who doesn't return your text.
What's more heartbreaking than an Uber driver not texting you back when you say, do you fancy going for a beer? Generally, that I can laugh about now, Tim. That was a low point where I thought, I've got no listeners here, I've got no mates. This was my response to anxiety. What a fucking idiot. Why have I chosen this? It's the world's worst midlife crisis. And, you know, it's even... You know, my wife, women make friends really easily. They're always recruiting, aren't they, the sisterhood? Middle-aged men, you've not got enough time to see your own mates. I remember one day my wife said, look, you know, the sales team, she'd been into the radio show, those sales guys seem like young guys. Why don't you go back into work on a Friday at 4 o'clock, right, and just sort of hang around a bit there and see if they're going down the pub? I went... That is beyond David Brent. Well, I'm suddenly going to rock up in a leather jacket, reeking of aftershave, going, hey, guys, where's everyone going tonight? It's too creepy. I can't do that. And so, yeah,
interestingly, though, in your book, I was in Canada once and I was just traveling around and I got to Canada and I was like bored, like exactly like you're saying. And I was like, I don't know what to do. And I'd been traveling these Australians and they're buggered off and I couldn't be bothered to go with them. And I was heading back. They wanted to go to the West Coast and I was heading back down the East Coast to get to New York and fly home. So I walked into a hairdressing salon and I said, I want that guy to cut my hair because he looked cool. So I'm in Toronto and he cut my hair and then I went to him, what are you doing tonight? And I thought that's the only way I'm going to find someone to hang out with. Yeah. And I ended up moving in with him and his mates just in his
flat. But
yeah, they let me move in for a few days. And it was just like, they were really into Bauhaus and music like that. Like, Jesus.
Wow.
It was hardcore and they kept taking mushrooms constantly. And I was like, oh, I'm a bit scared. But you end up befriending a hairdresser.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. And he's still a friend now. But even that was tough. There was this hairdresser that my wife and I both went to, and I'd get on really well with him. My wife kept like saying, why don't you ask him his number? When I've been so crushed and burned by the Uber driver not getting back to me. Right. He texts me out of the blue, this hairdresser, right? And he says, hey, what are you up to tonight? I'm meeting up with a couple of mates. We're going to have a couple of glasses of wine and some pizza. Do you want to come along? And I was like, at last. I go along. And then second drink in, I say to him, hey, look, it's really kind of me to do it. Really kind of you to do this. Thank you. And he goes, oh, it's okay. Your wife told me that you're really lonely. And I remember going, right. I went to a tour and I rang my wife, went, why you don't say that to another guy? It's embarrassing for me. She goes, but you are. I went, yeah, but stop telling the truth.
You know what? This would be a great Netflix series. Like it's so surreal, your story. You know, I thoroughly enjoyed reading it because you're like so successful over here. And I watched you try so hard from XFM. I mean, you put the hours in. You work your absolute nuts off and tried so many different ideas. And you end up on Virgin, changed to Absolute. It's huge. You're winning awards, you know. And it was a glory time of radio back then. That, you know, your competitors, Moyles and Evans, Jesus Christ. Yep. With his big...
What a time to grow up doing radio. Hey, how lucky was I?
Jesus Christ. I can't even name the breakfast DJs now. I mean, I know Evans is still doing it. Moyles is doing... but it's not like it was in those days with Radio 1 and Virgin and all that sort of stuff, all hammering each other. And then you moved there and you're what's great about it is your listeners hate you, your daughters are struggling at school, that's not a good thing, you know, your wife's a bit worried about it and her mum's ill at home, I've got no friends, and it's just this moment where you've gone from the most successful thing to basically you've gone down to nothing, haven't you, really?
Yeah, that's it. It actually was. I gave my life away, and for a while, it was just relentlessly. And let's not forget, right, my job the next morning, 5 days a week was, hey, good morning, Melbourne. And you got to front it out, where inside you're like, I can't take much more of this, you know. And you're like going, how are you today? You know, and you're trying to form a relationship with these people that are actually, it's like you're cold calling. And they're like, no, what, stop calling. You know, why are you still here? How do you get this number? And then, but what they did do is they did give me a go, and they went from no, 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 no to, oh, this is different. There's something different about him. And I was only ever came here to just build something alternative in the morning. And I stayed true to that. It's the hardest thing I've ever done on the radio, but also the most exciting. And then the show got to number one. It's been to number one. It's been at number one for a year and a half. And the ratings here are every 5 weeks. In the UK, it's every 3 months. It's very, very hard to, as a complete unknown, to get to number one. And it happened within 17 months. And it's because people, I think they were looking for something different. And I think that what had gone on, Tim, those couple of years of the struggles and a kind of humbling and a stripping away of some stuff and learning some stuff and having to be a bit more vulnerable. And it's hard staying in vulnerability, you know, and especially as you're a guy and you're on the radio and then suddenly you're the other side of the world and you don't want to appear weak, like some sort of, you know, weak British guy. But I couldn't be who I was in the UK. And also that wasn't right. I needed to change. It was a time for me to evolve. And so when I started to move into vulnerability on the radio in the right kind of way. And I think if you've really had despair in your life, the wonderful thing it does give you is you see it in other people. You see it very quickly. You become, it's like a superpower. Because you once you've tasted your own despair, that real, I'm not sure I can carry on. I'm really alone here. This is awful. Once you've had that in your life, you see it in other people. And I could here in Australia. And I thought, I know how to help them. I know what that's like. And I brought some of that to a radio show. And that was a game changer. And that's when they got to know me. If I just carried on trying to be funny like I had in the UK, and I know I'm good at being funny, but that wouldn't have been enough. It wasn't right for me anymore. I needed to do something else. I needed to evolve like I was off air a bit, bring it onto on air. And that's been the big game changer for me in my personal life and on air, and kind of bringing them together, really. And that's when they were like, now I know who you are. All right. Yeah. Okay. Now this is something different. I can connect you on this level because you're talking about real things in life. And a lot of breakfast radio these days is just noise. And I'm sometimes noise as well, but it's never about anything real. And it's not like you want, it's time for thinky thoughts on a Monday morning at 10 past eight. But do you know what I mean? It's being able to talk about all of life, right? All of our emotions. That's what I wanted. That's what I wanted to do on the radio here. I can only do that if I've been reduced to what I was, having to go and see a guy in a shed and paying him to listen to me, and sometimes like you, crying and thinking, what is this going to do? How are these tears going to help? You know, are there any more tears to come? And then, you know, putting yourself back together in a different way and not quite bolted up as you were before. So yeah, it long answer, but I think when I look back now, I never thought I'd ever be able to say this. I'll always be grateful for those anxiety attacks. They were genuinely the best thing that ever happened to me. For a very long time, they were the worst. And I just want them, like, that part of me cut out. I really did. Whereas now, they won't define me. They'll always inform me. And I think, but I know that's made me a better person. And it's certainly made me a better dad. I've got two teenagers, you know, 16 and 14, and they are going through, they have been through tough times as teenagers, you know, and all the extreme lockdown they had last year. And my struggles have made me a better dad, I hope it has, to them.
This week's sponsor, Clean Co, creates non-alcoholic alternatives to your favourite full-strength spirits with all the flavour but a fraction of the calories. Whether you're into gin, rum, vodka or tequila, Clean Co has a delicious option for you from just 12 calories per serve. Clean Co spirits have over 4,500 five-star reviews on Trustpilot, so head over to clean.co to ditch hangovers and drink clean. Right now at clean.co, you can get 15% off each of the spirits until the 17th of June, reduced from £19 to £16 for a limited time only, with free shipping across the UK and Ireland.
Back to the podcast with this week's sponsor, Clean Co. Non-alcoholic alternatives to your favourite full-strength spirits with all the flavour, but a fraction of the calories.
Are you? Have you mastered it now then, or is it still working?
No. Progress? No, still getting it wrong.
I think that's a good message for everyone, because I'm still work in progress. I started this podcast.
I really am.
I'd read so many self-help books and stuff, and I thought it started as an Agni Aunt column and sort of thing.
I know, I remember.
Agni Uncle. And then I thought, you know what? I'll just start interviewing people. And generally, I speak to a lot of people. It's funny. One of the things that I just thought about then when you were talking is if you recognize it in other people once you've been through it. And it's so weird interviewing a lot of celebrities like I do on my show.
Because
a lot of them come in and you can see their damage. And then when the lights and the cameras come on, they go. And I keep thinking, I wonder, I know the public are sick of celebrities saying they have mental health problems and everything.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's the industry creates the mental health problems or it attracts people like us.
Both is true. Time. Yeah, I think both is true, Tim.
I think I desperately wanted acceptance and love and I think I was like a moth that, you know, like flying to broadcast. Yeah. And then when you get there and you get it all and we both
and what does that do then? What happens then?
And then it runs out, doesn't it? You're like, I've done it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you think, oh, if I get that, I'll stop feeling this then and it'll fill this hole in me. And then it doesn't. And you're like, what? Oh God, what does that mean? You know, and then you have to accept that. I think, you know, one thing that's really nice is when you talk about this kind of stuff, and I thought if I'm going to write a book, and my whole book isn't all about this, it's part of my story, like I said, but if I'm going to write a book about why I moved here, then I'm going to actually be honest about this. Because I kept saying to my daughters, hey, it's okay to struggle. This is what life is a lot of time. It's struggling. You've got nothing to be ashamed of. And one of them said to me, what do you know about it? And I kept my mouth shut. I felt, because I think, I've never told anyone. They don't know about what happened to me. I don't want them to. Why is that? I was thinking, it's because I want them to think that I'm superhuman, that I'm strong, and I'll always be strong as a dad and as a man. And I realized they don't need me to be strong and superhuman. That's only going to create distance between me and them. And so I started to tell them about it. And I said, I'm writing this book. And they're like, you're going to put it in there? And I was like, Dad, I put that right at the beginning of the book then. And it came from my conversations with them about vulnerability. And you're right, it's a bit of a thing now. And I guess any conversations about mental health, but I think some people are getting a bit suspicious. Like, is it just a thing now where you have to say that it's a badge on your book? This, I wouldn't say this is about mental health, what happened to me. It's about life. It's about coming of age. That can happen to you at 18, 21, 29, 33. I open still having a coming of age when I'm on my deathbed and I get some new awareness. Like, oh, shit, just as the light goes out. That's what it's about.
Christian, I think a good way of putting it in context is the way that you succeeded in Australia in the end was to actually focus on people and their needs as portrayed in the book. And so your audience had empathy for you and the people that I suppose you should tell us one of the stories or something of how you got the audience engaged with you in the end.
Now my biggest learning after all this time on the radio was empathy is a thing that's in real short supply right now in the world. There's a lot of people trying to be funny in the morning, and I'm one of them, and there's not a lot of people who are happy to bring empathy because they go, well, that's not that funny. How's that going to rate? And they get all those kind of, you know, conversations around it. Whereas sometimes there's a lovely quote I read. Sometimes the new you meet in the form of a stranger, and like your physiotherapist suddenly going from maybe the first time you saw him to suddenly some point later, he hands you a piece of paper, you know, reaching out to you, and you go and meet someone else the first time. And then they become a mentor. They become a bit of a guide in your life. And about 9 months into the show, it wasn't going very well. And I was still plowing on, just thinking, I know the show's good. But I was burning out with just the effort of trying to be funny every day. And just holding tightly, like you were saying a while ago. And I got this email from a guy called Peter Logan. In Australia, the government, the moment you hit 50 when you're a guy, you get sent a self-diagnosis bowel cancer screening test. It's just a little stick you put up your ass, okay? And most men, as you can imagine, shove it at the back of the wardrobe and go, I'm not doing that. They're a vanity and all that kind of stuff. Peter Logan's one of them, and he was dying of stage 4 bowel cancer because he didn't do the test, and he would have got screened. They would have realized very early on, very treatable, but he was dying. And he said, could you read out my story as a warning to your listeners? And I rang him, and he was brilliant. He was a really funny guy. He lived in the UK. He was a gooner. And I said, why don't you come on the radio show yourself? There's no one better to talk about it. And I remember everyone around me was like, what? What do you mean? My wife said, people don't want to hear about bum cancer at 10 past 8 on a Thursday morning. And she was right. She goes, you haven't got the listeners to have the wiggle room to suddenly have cancer corner. You know, this is, no, please don't do this, right? And everyone around me, you can imagine this English guy going, I'm going to get a guest on tomorrow to talk about cancer. He's dying. And they're all like, oh, God, he's really having this. Is he determined to tank it now? Does he want to get fired? But I took another leap and I did it. And it'll always be something that I'm really proud of, that because of what he did. Peter came and he was brilliant. He had this energy. He was refused to be bowed by his condition, his diagnosis. He was inspirational. And he talked quite honestly about that he was dying of cancer. And I remember at the end of the hour, I said, why are you really here? What is it you've got to say to us? And he was saying, you know, do the test, please. It's insurance. And he said, you know, and he was there with his 19 and 20 year old daughters. He said, I'm not going to get to walk my daughters down the aisle. And oh my God, Tim, you know, sometimes you might have done this in your career when you just know, oh my God, if you're listening to this right now, this is not background. And I suddenly literally grabbed my chest. I thought it was going to explode. It was all this emotion suddenly. What a line. I'm not going to get to walk my daughters down the aisle because I didn't do the test. And it changed everything. The first thing that happened was he urged men to do the test and send it back, right? Go and dig it out and do it. And he said, if you're going to do it, say, put on the back, Peter sent me. Within 3 weeks, the Cancer Council of Australia said that an 800% increase, right, in return kits. He literally saved lives. And he spent, like I said, quite a few years in the UK. And I went to see him about sort of 10 days before he died. And he was clearly dying. But he was still there. And I remember he was a big gooner. And I said, do you know that you're near the end now? What does that feel like? He said, to be honest, I just want to die before Liverpool lift the cup. And I remember laughing so hard. That's what it is to be a football fan, isn't it? Where even in your dying moments, you can still find a positive. At least I hope I'm dead before I see fucking Liverpool lift the cup. He was that typical bitter gooner. And then about a day or two before he passed away, he sent me an email just sort of saying, hey, thanks for everything. And I was like, Jesus, you changed my life. You know, you showed me something that maybe that was always there, but you really showed it to me and the listeners as well. And you would have saved lives. What's better than that? And he said, keep up the good work, you know, keep up the humor, but never forget the human. And you know, we're talking about how a stranger comes into your life. Keep up the humor, never forget the human. I look at that little one line before every radio show. Mm. And it just reminds me, don't just try to be funny. All right.
So that then your audience then had empathy with you and with Peter, obviously. By the way, that made me cry reading it. So well done on that, because you managed to put that in words, which was nice.
I hope so, because no, I'm aware that the book is, you know, it's my story and it's out in Australia and the UK. And it's like, well, why would this relate to you? But I guess, like I said, Tim, it's about life, isn't it? It's about what happens to us.
Do you know the other bit which made me well up in your book? Was the bit where you put the bands together, old bands together.
Oh, and, God. And yeah, why I love I that. I thought you'd so, like that.
Why I love that so much is I had a dream. I had a dream that I was going to work on TV, and I had a dream that I was going to work on radio, and I fulfilled it, you know, and I'm now doing my podcasting and everything else, and it's great. And I just think about all those other people who went, I'm going to do it. We're in a band. Yeah. And then something happened.
And Tim, that easily could have been you or I.
Yeah.
You know,
You better explain that
item. Yeah. It was when I was like trying to sort of do new ideas here. Live music's really big in Melbourne, really big here. And it's like the live music capital of Australia. Not British bands come out here and they always start here. They love playing here. And I thought this is going to be another way to connect with them, you know. And so we did this thing where there was a big music festival and I got an opening spot for a band. And I didn't want to do like a battle of the bands. It's not right for my sort of 30, 40, 50 somethings audience. I just started with the question, did you used to be in a band, right? And do you fancy trying to put the band back together? I've got a gig in front of 25,000 people. And you could tell some people were like, oh, I don't know. And so at first there was a lot of men that were like, oh, I don't know. Wives were calling in, daughters were calling in. My dad said that they would have been bigger than Pearl Jam, but the drummer slept with the guitarist's girlfriend and they had a fight on stage. We're getting all these amazing stories. And again, this is within the first 8 months of the show. And I'm running this and it becomes something because suddenly it's not about my accent. It's not about the fact I'm not here. We can meet here, can't you? Because you would have had dreams. Did you used to be in a band? You know that you, maybe you were really talented. I know lots of bands were up when I grew up. You would as well. That were really good. Could have gone all the way, but just didn't because that's just the way it works. It's not a fair industry. It's not a meritocracy. The best don't always get signed up. And so straight away, we were getting these amazing stories. And then I was hiring private detectives to try and track down former band members that were in like Tasmania. And we narrowed it down to three bands. I hired a proper like Camden dirty sticky floor pub, invited 200 listeners, and we did a little mini battle of bands. But these guys were in that their 50s and 60s. And afterwards, they all had tears in their eyes because their kids and their wives and their family had got to see them not as the kind of who they were now. They got to see them in a very different way, as someone that used to have dreams.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the daughters of some of the dads that were in these reunited bands from the 80s and 90s were saying, like, oh, the last couple of weeks he's been jamming with his mates. I've never seen him look so happy. He's lightened up a bit. And that was a lovely thing to do. I loved it. Now I'm going to do it. Fingers crossed if we can have live music back probably at the end of this year. I'm going to do it again at the end of this year. I love doing that.
In life, we need purpose, don't we? And we need to get up in the morning and to have... it's really funny waking up this morning knowing that I'm going to interview you, having read the book, and I know you're going to... We know each other. I know it's going to be a good chat. And it's like, yeah, you get like a little buzz going because you're like, I'm going to do something today. And I suppose...
But Tim, you know what's really nice is I felt the same way. But what was exciting this time, I remember like 15 years ago, if we'd have had a beer, we'd have been going, I'm going to do this idea, I'm going to do that, and gossip and stuff like that, right? And we would have enjoyed it then. That's where we were. Was now, you know, what I was really interested in, it was like, I'm dying to know how Tim is. What helped him? Where's he at right now? What the last couple of years been like for him? And I talk about what it's been like for me. This is the most real, honest conversation we've ever had.
Yeah,
we wouldn't have been able to do it 15 years ago because we weren't there. Mm. It'd have been odd. You would have turned around if I started talking like this, going, what the hell? What's going on with him? Where's he going with this? You know, I would have thought the same about you, going, Jesus, Tim's going through some stuff. You know, whereas now we're like, yeah, yep, I get it. It's like swapping war wounds now. And I really like that. It's really nice. It's a different opening, isn't it?
Reading your book, as I say, was inspiring because you took that plunge. I'm not sure I'm brave enough to do that.
But you don't have to take that kind of plunge. And really, right, even if you don't get the book, you know, and I try and nail what I was trying to say in the book was like, it wasn't about moving 10,000, 12,000 miles. It was about moving closer into my heart. And I know that sounds like some kind of awful Facebook Monday hashtag motivation.
Let's stick it on a pillow, a cushion.
Yes, but it's a fridge magnet, Monday motivation. But it does boil down to that. That leap, that plunge, sometimes the hardest one ever is coming back to yourself and accepting yourself. That's your hardest journey in life ever. It isn't about moving the other side of the world.
The other thing, though, about your book, which I love, is you talk about all the ideas. And I mean, you had so many ideas on your radio shows. I had loads on mine. But you did as well.
I was telling someone the other day about Soccer AM.
Yeah.
And just how, what a groundbreaking show that is.
That's what I love. And that's the thing about your book is I love coming up with ideas. And that's the bit too. that I like doing. I miss radio for that because the immediacy of it and the liveness of it.
And the demands of it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say to you. The demands of radio are, I always had a TV career running alongside radio, so I could never do the 5 days a week thing. It was just too exhausting. It's, people don't realize, like, TV is a bit of a breeze, really. You I mean, my show's 3 hours long on a Sunday, so it's kind of one of the, I say harder ones. It's only 3 hours, but it's quite intense. But with radio, you're doing that 5 days a week or 4 days a week, however many days, and you've got to keep on coming up with ideas and things. And when I moved from TV to radio, I didn't realize what a slog it was. Who employed you at XFM when we met? Was it Andrew Phillips?
Yeah, Andrew Phillips. So yeah, what a time when Tim and I were there. You know, you were doing your evening show, which again was full of ideas and creativity. That radio station for a couple of years was just about as good as you can get radio. I mean, we had Ricky Gervais, Steve Merchant, and obviously Carl Pilkington. He used to just be like you and I. He used to just make the production.
Yeah.
Now he's a BAFTA-winning multi-millionaire, right? Which and he deserves to be. He was always like smarter and funny than any of us.
Yeah.
You know, and you had Zane Lowe, you know.
Zucks.
It was Zucks.
Derm O'Leary was there.
Yeah, it was. There were so many great presenters there, right? And it was a really, really exciting time. And I'm always grateful for the 5 years I had there. But yeah, in terms of the coming up with ideas and that buzz, I still love that. I still get a joy from something happening and me going, oh, it's like today I went to get my vaccine, right? And obviously, like, it was like all masked up, we're in lockdown. You turn up for your allotted time and everyone was there, it's all quiet. And they'd obviously paid for it, the vaccine people, right? They paid for an accordion player. You know, like at Disneyland, they have those entertainers that keep you sort of company. And for some reason, they thought the best way that people want to cheer them up as they wait for their vaccine is they'd hired an accordion player. It was playing like this actual, like an accordion in this big exhibition center where there were thousands of people. And as I rocked up, I was trying to work out what the song was, and he was doing Whiter Shade of Pale. And I don't know if he was taking the piss or because, like, people look really nervous about having a needle in their arm. And I was like nodding at him, like, I get the song. That's funny, mate. And so as I was waiting, I started to look on YouTube, like, are there any other accordion versions of well-known songs? And there's loads. There's like Pearl Jam. There's like Nirvana. So tomorrow morning, I'm going to do name this song on the accordion to see.
Brilliant.
It's trying to bring back and reappreciate the humble accordion for the great. I had them in any number one songs with even an accordion in them. I don't know.
It's funny working at XFM because I'd come from TV and I'd gone on to radio and I wasn't arrogant. I just went, it's easy. And I wasn't arrogant enough to think after a couple of weeks, I was like, I'm crap at this. Then I had a chat with Richard Parks, who you mentioned in your book, by the way, who told me I was crap. And then
he told me I was crap once as well. And he was right. He called me into the show and he went, you ever do a link like that again, I'm going to fire you. And I actually did a phone in one day. I just had no ideas. I had a terrible hangover and I had 3 hours to fill. And I said, I'll give a prize to the first person who can tell me how many dimples are on a golf ball. It's shit. It's the sort of thing you might do on Magic FM or something like that. Not an indie station like XFM that was for 5 years the coolest radio station in the world. And Baharki just called me in and he said, you ever do a link like that again, I'll fire you. And he gave me a kick. And he was right. I was phoning it in. He called me out on it. And well, I'll always be grateful for that. Whenever I see a golf ball now, I always get flashbacks. Like, oh, there's 364.
By the way, Richard Parks, he sort of ran Capital Radio, got it up to its glory days with Chris Tarrant and all that lot. And XFM was under that umbrella. We were all there. And he was quite blunt. And he went to me, I'm really glad you're on the station, but you're not very good. And he said, you're never going to be a breakfast radio DJ, right? And I was really upset by that. Then Andrew Phillips sort of said to me, Tim, you're not painting pictures. Radio is about painting pictures. And it really stuck with me, that one little thing. I think Andrew Phillips, by the way, doesn't get the credit. He put all those celebrities on that crappy little...
It was a great talent spotter.
Yes.
And it was like, you know, he was watching MTV, right? And he saw some kid from New Zealand called Zane Lowe on the couch, right? And he spotted that. This is like 20, 18 years ago, way before anybody else, and just gave raw talent. He just put people on the radio who had never done necessarily a radio show, but just know these people know how to talk. These people know how to connect. These people know how to communicate their work out, those bits. And he made that radio station phenomenal.
Yeah, there was me bumbling through my. I used to share a slot with Zane Lowe. Do you know that? I used to do
yeah,
something
because
like.
Weren't you Tuesday and a Thursday?
I think I
was
Tuesday,
Wednesday,
Wednesday,
and Friday. It's like a flat
like
share. It's like a flat share in London, the two of you. And I remember that Zane Lowe, because he's a bit different, bless him, they used to have to turn the studio lights off on and off for him to like pump up the energy in the studios. It was like a nightclub. Did you ever see his show? He'd be like jumping up and down. Hey, man, we got 60 minutes coming up of deep grooves. And I'd never heard a music presenter like that. He was so passionate and articulate about music, and then I'd hear him teasing like an interview with a music producer. I'm like, I'm not going to listen to this. And then he did that thing that very good interviewers do, where they draw you into an interview with like Tony Visconti, who used to be Bowie's producer, and you think this is going to be a bit dry, and then he got all these great stories out of them. And I was, you know, and you would come along, you had this indie sensibility that you built this amazing atmosphere up on that show that was, again, it was quite knockabout, and you'd have Carl on the air sometimes, and it was like a kind of late night, early evening breakfast show. That was the energy I liked about it.
Yeah, I mean, it was so surreal watching Zane, because he was so talented.
And yeah, ridiculously
me
talented.
Just bumbling
yeah.
along on the slots in between.
I'm doing phone ins about how many dimples in a golf ball.
What I realized reading your book, though, which is really interesting, is I realized that a lot of radio is aimed at the industry, and it's aimed at the like the celebrity. Mm. I cared about the listener more
when I came here, right, it's even worse here, right? It's every day they expect you to have a celebrity on, like, and I came here and I don't do that. I might have a guest on maybe 2 or 3 year tops. And they were like, one of the team said to me, well, what are you gonna talk about? I went, there's so much more to talk about in life than getting some bozo on. I used to be in season 3 of Big Brother. I ain't gonna get anything out of him. I don't care. I didn't come here just to get, you know, all the guests on that are on all the other breakfast show. What's the point? I didn't show up to do that. And so I've never been that interested. I'm more interested in what's going on with the listeners and playing out what's this song on an accordion.
So when I did Five Live, I did the 606 midweek before yep. they got rid of it. And I used to be far more interested in the fan experience.
Oh,
than what was
yeah,
going
but you were
on
like,
on
that
pitch.
Was soccer AM. That was a game-changing way to have sport.
Because I think, and I only realised this from reading your book, that I'm actually interested in the person, not the actual
the actual
thing. I remember doing an item on XFM where I said, what's a con that you've been involved in? And a greengrocer phoned me up. And this is brilliant. A greengrocer phoned me up and said, I'm a greengrocer, and when my mushrooms are on the turn, I stick organic on them and put the price up.
And what a con.
And he goes, they just sell out. And he goes, the best thing is the customers always come back and go, they were the best mushrooms I've ever had. And I just loved all that stuff.
What's better than that, right? That's real life, okay?
Oh, that's brilliant.
And I just thought that there's more stories. I'm more interested in getting those stories on the radio because they're heartwarming, you know, and I those stories like that is what I'm obsessed with every single day. You know, that I find far more interesting and joyous and funny, like your story, far better than listening to some interview that everybody else is doing. And they're all talking, but they're not saying anything.
Yeah, I mentioned in the intro about Ray Jars and the Sony Awards. And I was saying in my intro to you how important they are for radio. It's not the same with TV, but when I went to radio, that and I think it's because the industry takes it so seriously. In I don't know what it's like, obviously you just mentioned actually in Australia it's even more so.
Yeah, it is more intense,
but they take it so seriously, and I think it's the only opportunity you have of saying, can I keep my job or can I have a pay rise if you get the good Ray Jars coming in. And fortunately I never had to worry about that. I was never doing the breakfast show like you've always done in your career, but they become just so ridiculously important. Yet as I understand it, they're done in such a basic way, aren't they, the Ray Jars still? Are they the same in Australia, like pens and papers and things?
Yeah, exactly the same thing. Diaries to be ticked. Yeah, they hand out, say, in a city like London, you'd be lucky if they hand out 3,500 diaries, you know, to 11, 12 million people. And that's every 12 weeks. And that's going to decide people's careers. But here's the thing about it, right? If your show's done well, you go, that's great. Yeah, this stuff works. It's brilliant. And then when you've not done well, went, bloody methodology. Methodology's let us down, you know. Bloody methodology, data sampling, And so, you know, you love it when you go up, when you go down, like, it, there needs to be a change. What year are we in right now? And they do matter, but I've tried, and it was very hard here because in the UK, once you reach, once you've got your audience, it will bounce around a little bit up and down, but you've got your core that like you, and that can sustain a career. So Wogan was great at, he just super served that audience, be consistent, show up for them. And you've got, you can, if you're smart, you've got a career for as long as you want it, really. Whereas here in Australia, I didn't have any of that to rely on. If I didn't get the ratings, I'd be sacked and it'd be back to the UK. And you don't just walk into a radio show like I had. It's, you're out there again, out in the wilderness. And so, yeah, then the ratings became, and here, you'll love this. Not only are the ratings every 5 weeks, they're every 12 weeks, every 3 months in the UK, which is far more civilized. It's on the evening news. I remember one day just sitting down, and I see my face at the bottom of a downward slope, like a ski slope. And I went, oh my God, that's me. Oh, this ain't going to be good. And it was the ratings. The guy went, expensive UK import. Christian O'Connell is still struggling. And I was like, oh my God, why is it on the news here? And the kids all saw it. And I was just like, oh, this is relentless. It's actually on the news here, ratings. Why? What? Does everyone need to know how badly I'm doing? Because you're the only English guy. Suddenly people would recognise my accent. You're the only English guy on the radio in Australia. And so, like, oh, you're the English guy on the radio. And then there'd be this awful silence where that hung between us. I was like, yeah, it ain't going very well at the moment. I know. Thanks.
What do you think's happening with the radio industry? It's interesting because, like TV, it's lost its impact a tiny bit. You mentioned your audience in 30s, 40s, 50s. I was speaking to my twins the other day. They're 19. I said, what radio do you listen to? They said, well, we just haven't. We just don't. They just go on their phones constantly. And there used to be a time when I was talking about the glory days I was just talking about before with you and Chris Evans and Chris Moyles, where whatever you lot were doing was in the newspapers, constantly front page of the newspapers. And you were creating news. I don't even know Radio 1 breakfast show DJ is at the moment. Who is it? Do you know?
It's Greg James.
Oh, is it Greg James? Nice bloke.
Yeah, and he's good actually. Good, like him. He's good.
Yeah, he's a lovely guy. But he's not getting
it. It doesn't have the same cut through.
But nor's Chris Evans, and he's on Virgin, and nor's Moyles. None of them are really getting headlines over here like it used to be. Everyone used to be, you know, just listening to the radio shows for those exclusives constantly. Is it the same in Australia, or is it slightly different? What's going on?
It's slightly different here, but I tell you what is exactly the same is radio, especially breakfast radio, has gone so lazy. You wouldn't have had half these shows that are on air now. You know, I won't name names, but you wouldn't get half those shows on air 15, 20 years ago. They wouldn't have cut the mustard. They wouldn't have been hired. They would have been sacked. They're phoning it in. I've always thought I'm in a very, very privileged position to be someone's mate in the morning. And there was a time in my life when I first moved to London, I had a sales job I didn't want, ironing my shirt. And I'd be listening to Evans do his breakfast show on Virgin Radio when he was really at his peak, you know, on Radio 1, thinking, I want to do that. What a job. And it was making me smile. He put a smile on my face. He changed my mood that morning. I thought, what a thing to do. I know what that meant to me, getting on the train, going to a job I didn't want to do. And so I always thought it's a very privileged position to this. That's never lost on me, the gratitude I have. And it comes down for management not wanting to take risk. They just want lowest common denominator. So's got half a million Instagram followers. And what does that mean about what they're like at communicating or talking on the radio? Because that's what the job is, and connecting people. And they're hiring from the wrong pools now. I was a complete unknown. I was working on the radio station doing a breakfast show in Liverpool when I got tapped up by XFM, by Andrew Phillips, who just saw that I had raw potential, thought I might do okay, took a punt on me. None of us knew, but he just saw, like with Zane Lowe, like with you, like Ricky Gervais, he just put us all on air and hoped that we'd figure it out along the way, and gave us space.
He'd been watching Soccer AM and he went, come and do the show. So he just called me in and said, you fancy doing it? And I went, yeah. And it was just amazing.
And that way of, like, putting untested talent on the radio now doesn't exist as much. And so what happens when you take less risks? What do? You go lowest common path of denominator, and that nothing, no great entertainment, art, nothing great comes out of that. And that's why the radio you get now is quite diluted. It's quite weak. It's all quite homogenized. You've got a lot of radio stations playing the same kind of music, talking about the same kind of things. Mm. And I think that's a trickle-down cookie-cut approach that comes from above. They're doing the shows that they've been hired to do, to be fair.
Do you know, I went on Chris Evans's breakfast show maybe a year or so ago, and the buzz was incredible. The guy still...
Oh, I bet.
Still just...
Look, the guy's... Chris is one of the very best, right?
The magic.
At doing radio. He's got such a... You know, I still tune in occasionally now, and he gives me that buzz. It makes me feel excited about going back on the radio. You know, I might listen to a podcast of his on a Sunday night when I'm sort of, you know, oh God, am I still going to do it? And then I hear that, I go, God, the radio's brilliant. God, being alive's brilliant. He's still got this gift. Mm. And I think that's just a given talent. And I think he's one of the best to ever be on the radio.
What was it like for you back then when you were up against Chris Moyles, Chris Evans, Chris Brilliant. O'Connell, everyone had to be called Chris. What was it like? I mean, did you feel the pressure?
No, I loved it. I loved it. I was, when Moyles went away, when Evans went away, I hated it. They weren't on Breakfast Radio. They had left it for a couple of years. I kept going, and I really struggled. You know, it's like when I watched The Last Dance, and I hear Michael Jordan's, or he really needed these battles he would create. And he would always go, and I took it personally, and then like go and play amazingly. When I knew they were on air at the same time, I always knew, right, we've got to do a show today, because if this starts to, you know, if we're not good enough, they're going to flick around. And I loved that. It was like, it's like when you watch it, when soccer teams get better by playing the best football teams, don't they? You know, you want to know, oh, this is going to be a really tight game. I'm a big UFC fan. And I love to see it when it's two really great fighters where you don't know which way it's going to go. And so I was made better, because that was like a furnace going up against those two. And I was different. I had to do something different to them. And they were different to me, and the three of us. And it was a really, really exciting time. And I knew that I wound them up. Moyles, I remember once saying that I had more awards than listeners. And I knew that I got in his head. Right? I made it into a jingle.
That is good.
That
podcast. Is good.
That funny, is... right? And he was right. He was right. I did have more awards than listeners when I was next to him. And I thought, I'm in his head. I'm getting to Moyles. And he wasn't. It didn't bother me. But he used to get really irritated. And I remember once I lost an award and Scott Mills won it. And Moyles went on air and said, I'm glad Christian O'Connell didn't win that award. I'm not glad Scott Mills won it, but I'm just glad Christian O'Connell. And it was all these kind of vendettas that I was like, what's his problem with me?
Like, can I tell you? Everybody, it was really fun. Everybody, like all the DJs were really lovely to Soccer AM, because we had like this hardcore following of like, we had a really big audience.
I remember just seeing you get like Noel Gallagher would come on every 3 weeks to be like drunk/hungover because it was on a Saturday morning, and he would just be there for shits and giggles.
Well, I put Noel Gallagher on and Ray Winston without them promoting anything. They just wanted to come on the show. It's unheard of, really. But what's great is I was doing this and everybody was nice to me because of who we were getting on and everything, apart from Chris Moyles, who kept slagging me off. And I just loved it. And people would go, he's been slagging off on the radio again. They say, are you all right? And I'd go, it's brilliant. So I would then retaliate on Soccer AM.
Yeah, me too. Just to get... And I know I gained listeners,
fun.
Right?
Yeah.
Because people would go, who is this Christian O'Connell? Yeah. Oh,
exactly.
I don't know who he is.
Yeah.
He's really upset Moyles. And I know sometimes I get listeners where we're going, I only came over because Moyles, he kept slagging you off. Now I've started listening to the show. I'm actually really enjoying it. I used to love that, which is why I deliberately would always say a soundbite whenever he'd be moaning about me. I'd say something on air, knowing that it would get back to him, knowing that he'd have another go. And it was all this silly pantomime, to be honest. I'm sure if we met up now, we'd have a lovely chat. And you go, well, what was all that about? But I'll always be grateful that I grew up and cut my teeth in radio when those two were around. I think I always had an outsider underdog mentality that I still foster to this day, because I was like that over here. I was on XFM. You know, and then I was on, you know, Absolute, and they were on Radio 1 and Evans on Radio 2.
I think what Moyles sussed, I think he was a great broadcaster, by the way.
Yeah,
and I
100%.
I bumped into him a load of times, and I miss not having someone like him on the radio, actually.
Yeah, totally.
But what I thought he sussed was actually people are more interested in talking and the personalities of his staff and getting the listeners on and what's going on in his life than they are with the music. So he never used to play any bloody music. It was like the radio
and I love
on
that
breakfast
because actually,
show.
I remember reading this interview with Howard Stern, and he was saying Howard copped to the fact very early on that he was never going to stand out playing the same bunch of songs – that the other guy was going to play, that wasn't going to be enough, because anyone could, he could be sacked by anyone who could play those songs. He needed to be almost bigger than the music, and he built an act and persona around that. But yeah, I remember Chris Moyles doing a 12-minute link once when he used to do a Saturday morning show, right? And all it was about a barbecue he was having and who was bringing what food and how many sausages and where they were going to go to get the drink. Do we start with beer, move on to wine? And I don't know why, I loved all of it, right? I remember actually ringing my mates afterwards, went, let's have a barbecue, because I just was like, and again, it wasn't a shtick he was doing. It was just the last link of his show, and he overran, the news was late, and they were just doing what we all do. How many sausages do you think we need? Well, is he coming? Is John coming? There's 10 of us. How many sausages do you think you have at a barbecue? How many do people have at a barbecue? You don't have any more than two, do you? And then you're a bit full up. You might have a burger. No one has the chicken. No one has the... Don't bring a salad. No, men don't have a salad. And it was so real and in the right kind of way and entertaining. It was funnier than if he was trying to be funny. And I still love that. I still love that kind of radio. I think we all do. I don't know what it is.
I've done a few podcasts on here about the 90s recently with Alan McGee and Stephen Street.
And oh, wow. Like
that. And it's been, I mean, just reminiscing about those times. It really was our 60s, because everything was free. And you could do what you want on radio without people going, let's cancel Christian. Not saying that that's wrong now or anything else, but we, everyone, there was just this amazing freedom for people to do what the hell they wanted. And it was just, it was so exciting because we were all trying to push the boundaries constantly, all of us, weren't we, to try and outdo.
Yeah, music was driving it and sport was like Euro 96. Yeah. That Euro 96, some of the happiest times of my life. I remember what pubs I was in and suddenly strangers with mates. And I don't think we're ever going to know what it's like to win a World Cup, right? But that year, we didn't win it. But just what that magical time was like of Gazza and Evans and Three Lions, that was a magical time for us. And I'll always be grateful that we had that, where pop culture was really big. It was in politics. Noel was around at number 10. And the 80s has had this big thing the last couple of years, and people are loving it. My teenagers, they're on TikTok, listen to like 80 songs, stuff like that. I think the 90s is due for a long overdue big kind of re-examination, just about how much, and even indie music was mainstream then.
Well,
you know,
I tell you what,
the fashion was like massive. And you had all these great indie bands that were really different, but brilliant. There was such an explosion of when, for me, it felt like it was all about here, not just America. There was such a great, thriving, massive, mega indie scene here.
Well, the fashion's back. I mean, all the baggy clothes are back and the bucket hats are back. Prada are selling bucket hats for £410.
Are you kidding me? I wish I'd had all my kids. I saw one of my kids the other day in a Fila tracksuit top. I was like, Fila. She was like, how do you know about this? Went, I used to wear that. Back in the day, she went, what? You would have looked terrible. I wasn't born 48. Fila, Champion's back in. Gola. You know, all gazelles are still around as well, exactly. And samba.
Yeah, very true. Listen, we're coming to that. It's supposed to be an hour long, this, and we've already gone over it. So, don't worry about that. But just kind of finally, a couple of things. First, where do you think radio goes then in the future? Because it is evolving massively. Podcasting's come along, and I know in America, podcasting is becoming as big as radio. I think it's not quite the same over here or Oz, I don't think, but what is the future? What's happening?
I think that the great thing about, and it's interesting, isn't it, like you and I having this chat, I know that we couldn't have this on the radio. We'd have to break for a song or an ad break or the news or the traffic or whatever, and I cut my cloth accordingly in the morning, right? But I love having this kind of space. And there's a reason why people listen to you, Tim, is that they really like it. It's longer form. It's immersive. It's a proper conversation, isn't it, that can go into different areas. And there's not those spaces on TV. You don't get that on a chat show. It's still very bite-sized. And I think it's lovely that now people are going, if you just want to hear a podcast about, I don't know, UFC or needlecraft or... You know what? I don't know. Is there a needlecraft one? There must be.
Should be.
There should be, right? Anyway, I don't know why I went to needlecraft. But anyway, hopefully people get my point, is that it's giving you what you want in a longer way and more immersive. And I think that's only a good thing. And I think the future for talkers and stuff like that, I think will be podcasting will get bigger. because it's not podcasting. It's more, it's original content, isn't it? You know, and if you look at Spotify paying Joe Rogan to come and work only for them to do his, it's the biggest chat show in the world. And I think if you've got Spotify who are buying up podcasts now, you realize it's going to get bigger and bigger. And radio was very slow. It's like the music, it was like the record labels that did not get quick enough into the world that wanted streaming. They were changing their habits of how they consumed it. I think it's just they've been quite slow. They're like quite easy to go, it's all right for podcasting, you know, and stuff like that. It's like they need to encompass it. It's how people want to hear conversations, how they want to hear voice now. I think it's actually really interesting about where it'd be for me 10, 15 years' time.
Mm. All right, listen, last question.
Hairdressing salon. Me and you, buddy. Two sinks.
Me and you.
That's the next podcast. Me and Tim are going to do two sinks.
Final question then, because I ask everyone this. What's one piece of advice you'd like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Oh, God, then I will end it with Peter Logan. And that line that he said to me, keep up the humour, never forget the human. And, you know, Tim and I have just talked about our struggles and successes and all of that. That's all part of life, you know, and the word mental health gets kicked around a lot and that's all good. But actually, isn't mental health, it's about life. It's about what it is to be human. And it's inherently messy and awkward and hard and silent and wonderful and amazing, and it's all of that. And so, yeah, don't forget the human. That you know is an amazing, that's an amazing bit of wisdom.
And just one bit that I picked up in your book, which is something that I've learned to do and I try and do, is rather than living your thoughts, try and watch your thoughts. It's a better way of going.
It's exhausting, isn't it, mate? I mean, as a creative person, I think everyone does this, whether you're creative or not. We're all creative in some way or form. We live in our heads, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, how many times when you're having a decision, you go, I want my head on this one. My heart was telling me this, but I've ignored my heart. People always do that as if they've done something really good. Yeah, I've killed my heart and soul. I've gone with the head on this one. well done. Yeah, never listen to your heart, mate. That'll only get you in real trouble. And yeah, it is. It's that, isn't it, Tim? It's like, it's not, it's very hard. It's a daily thing, but not, it's coming out of your head a bit, however you do that.
Yeah. All right. There's plenty of advice in Christian's book, No One Listens to Your Dad's Show, From Number One to No One. It's not a self-help book, by the way, by any stretch of the imagination. There's just lots of good stuff in there.
Last thing you do is go to a DJ. You know, if you need help, don't come to a guy who plays Nickelback, for fuck's sake, okay?
That's what I always say. If you're taking advice off me, you're taking advice off a TV presenter, and that is a horrible idea.
But actually, you've been through some shit. I've been through some shit. You should have something to say about that. Yeah. It only works for us, but someone might pick something up. And I've always loved the fact that conversations like this, if I'd have heard this 8 years ago when I was thinking, oh my God, I'm not going to be all right. And I heard, you know, you and I talking like this, it would make me feel a bit alone. This is why people like listening to you, Tim. Your life has been zigs and zags, and you're probably not where you thought you would have been 10 years ago. I'm certainly not. But aren't you grateful that you've got stuff like this in your life? I am. And your evolution and changes through, you know, real tough times, those life quakes that happen to us. But they open up something else and what they take away as well.
Perfect. Great way to end. Thank you so much, Christian. Lovely to speak to you today.
Hey, thanks, Tim. This has been lovely. Really, really nice. I hope we get the chance to do it again. And I hope we get to open up that hair salon.